There's something new from our friends at Text Control. TXT Text Control supports the integration of legally binding electronic document signatures into your ASP.NET Core web applications. Simply use MS Word documents, prepare them using the Text Control online editor, and request signatures from signers. It works just like well-known e-sign services, but it runs on-premises in your infrastructure without sending and storing documents somewhere else. To showcase typical workflows and the Text Control electronic signature technology, they published a fully functioning demo that you can use to create and request signatures, sign documents, and validate executed PDF files. See the demo at esign.textcontrol.com. That's esign.textcontrol.com. Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Ray Bango, developer and security advocate at Veracode. And we used to work together. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing great. Well, I mean, Scott, it was more than that. You hired me. You were my hiring manager.
I didn't want to overstate it, but we had a very enjoyable working relationship for a number of years.
We did. We did. It was fun. It was. I was able to learn a lot from you, especially around community involvement, and that was a big deal. So. And then you just left me. You went off to .NET land and you said, all right, that's it. I'm like, oh, where's Scott? And I cried. I curled into a box. Yeah. Oh, I curled into a ball and cried and moved on.
Well, you've done a lot of amazing things. We'll make sure to include links in the show notes. People can take a look at raybango.com, R-E-Y. You were a founding member of jQuery, and you've been doing web stuff for a very long time. And you have a deep interest in security, and you're currently really thinking smart and hard about how developers think about security. And I think it's a reasonable conversation starter to say that there are those that are deeply passionate as a developer about security, and then there are those that just kind of punt and try not to think about it.
That's a good way of saying it. And look, the way I think about security is that if you're a developer and you don't want to worry about security, nobody should be on top of you about it. I mean, I think it's an important thing to learn about. But ultimately, if you really think about it, when you became a developer, it's because you wanted to build these great experiences. You wanted to build something. That's what developers are. They're builders. They get excited about that code snippet that works. And especially if you do it on the first time, like I know that every bit of my code worked 100% on the first time that I deployed it. No errors ever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's important for developers to continue to have that fire that lets that inspires them to build these great experiences. And the thing is, though, that I was very much like that when I got into security about 3 years ago. It struck me that a lot of developers just don't think about it. It's kind of this weird IT problem, and the network folks will take care of it. But it's really become much more pervasive in the software stack. And I like to say software because if you think about the landscape nowadays, I mean, software touches so many different aspects. It touches SCADA systems that control your utilities. It, of course, you know, it's in your smartphone. And of course, it's in the websites that we use. So we have to be careful to dismiss software as not being a threat vector. It is a very big threat vector nowadays. And so what's happened is as threat actors have shifted their focus from cloud-based infrastructure, which is generally much more resilient, what are they focusing on? The applications that we build. And so as developers, we need to start considering whether we're actually using secure coding principles and we're actually taking the time to kind of patch up our stuff.
Security, though, is a requirement. It's the requirement on a list of features, but it's the biggest, most scary, most kind of threatening one. So it's like, you know, make sure this button does that and make sure the background is blue and oh yeah, security. And like the only secure computer is one that's not on and not plugged into the internet. It seems like it's so overwhelming. It's almost like human nature to procrastinate and ignore the giant thing that you should be focusing on. So I feel like I'm either deeply dedicated to security or I ignore it completely. Like, are we allowed to have a slider bar of how much I care about security?
Well, you hit it right on the head about security, just being involved in everything. And so when I first got into security, the very first instructor that I had, his name is Matthew Hickey, goes by the Twitter handle HackerFantastic. His slogan is all computers are broken, and they are, they literally are. And so, it's a hard thing because it is scary. A lot of people kind of see this as like, oh man, God, this security thing, what do I do with it? But ultimately we do have to consider it. Now, this whole slider concept, I've never really thought about that. That's actually pretty interesting. We can think of this slider concept in a way, because if you take the approach of nurturing and cultivating an environment where people who have this real interest and curiosity for security are kind of lifted up into a security champion's role, those can be the folks that help to create the bridges between the security folks who are doing a really valuable job. I mean, let's face it. Security people can be pains. We know it. But God bless them. I love security people because you know what? They're trying to protect us. And let's think Microsoft scale. Think about what Brett Arsenal has to deal with. And so there, it's a big deal. And so they have to focus on getting it right as much as possible. The saying goes, defenders have to get it right 100% of the time. Threat actors only have to get it right one time. And so as security practitioners or as development practitioners, we have to be mindful of security. Doesn't mean that you have to be the security expert, but there are some security coding principles, things like sanitizing inputs or evaluating things within your code base that could be common triggers for vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. Those are things that I think every developer should at least have a cursory understanding and then lean on people who are, let's say, application security experts or security champions to kind of validate. And of course, there's tools out there that can help you do some of this stuff without having it all be manual. I'm not an advocate for everything being manual. I just think let's automate some things and then try to lower the barrier to actual having manual intervention. So let's find that low hanging fruit. And then the rest of the stuff, we kind of work ourselves. Just think of it as like a QA process type of thing. You use right now, what is a tool you use, Scott, for doing your QA? Your code reviews and things like that.
Well, there's code reviews. There's Azure DevOps. There's reviewing code in GitHub. There's there's a pipeline of gates. There's security gates. There's DevOps gates. There's release gates.
You got it. And so that this should just be part of the quality assurance cycle, where you have this as another gate, and it just kind of fits into your CI and CD pipeline. And you get the results and you look at them and you say, okay, I understand what this means. And then you try to solve it, because ultimately a security issue is just a bug. That's what it boils down to. And I think as developers, we need to kind of change our mindset and say, well, maybe we should need to start addressing this as bugs, the same way we do code bugs. So that's kind of the way I look at it. But here's the thing. I do empathize with developers. Having been a developer for a long time, security is friction. And Scott, you know this. I mean, we're under pressure to release fast. Everything is fast. Oh, management wants fast and they want new features and blah, blah, blah. And everybody talks about DevOps and we need to get out faster. We need to deploy multiple times a day or multiple times a week. And when you factor in security, now you're like, okay, that's just adding another layer of friction. And I think that's part of the things that developers kind of are hesitant about when they think of security. They think of it as like a friction point. Something that's going to cause me to slow down my process or delay my coding. And I get that. I understand that. And it's not an unfounded conclusion. But if they shift it a little bit and start thinking of it as like a QA process, I wonder if that would change things.
So you just file a bug and you just think about it as like, this is a thing. But it seems like there's always unknown threats. There's always the security champion saying that this thing is the biggest, most scary, most horrible thing. Like, even the language that is used, like you've been pwned, is like very binary. You're either completely screwed or, you're soon to be completely screwed.
Right. And that's where the whole concept of zero trust networks and defense in depth comes in. It's funny because people talk about phishing. And phishing is actually, and to me, phishing is like a really big problem. It continues to be a pervasive
issue. It's a surprisingly large problem. I've been a member of a number of phishing tests, and you'll get the phishing mail and you'll go, you know, and then you're like, you thought you got me. And then you start talking to your coworkers and friends, and they're like, oh my God, I clicked on that message. And like, no one sent you a voicemail. That didn't even look right. Everyone's sense of what's an alleyway that you should walk between two buildings, and like, I'm not going to walk in that alleyway. And everyone's sense of security smell is different, you know?
Yeah. Phishing tests are fine. I get it. I'm
not sure what it proves, though, other than we always get nailed.
It's security awareness training. It's trying to figure out what level of the corporate population is actually understanding what phishing emails actually look like. But here's the thing. Being in security now, you dig into what these threat actors are doing, and they're so smart. It's almost to the point where you have to kind of respect them. It's this art form, I see it. And it's this weird dichotomy I have, because I'm constantly battling with, God, they're so smart, but I so dislike what they do, and it's hard. But I don't blame people when they fall for phishing scams nowadays, because they really are good. But here's the thing. One of the things I don't like is when somebody falls for a phishing scam and then people come down on them because it breaches their company. And ultimately, the way I look at it is, if one user falling for a phishing scam or clicking a link compromises your whole entire company, that means that your security posture was completely off, and your the way that you structured your defenses weren't meant to protect your company as a whole. It just wasn't set up properly. And so it goes back to all the concepts about zero trust and defense in depth, and you should have a layered approach.
It's interesting. So you're saying if I jiggled the door, the front door, and somehow was let into the house, but had no other security of any kind, it really isn't the fault of the person that left the door unlocked. There should have been multiple layers. There should have been a camera in the foyer, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree. Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. I love the way you break these things down. They're always awesome. But you know, it's people are too quick to blame that poor person who just fell for, sometimes in many cases, a really good phishing scam. Some of them are really good, Scott, and some, I mean, they are. I could fall. I'm sure I'm going to fall for one sooner or later. Maybe I've done so already, and I don't even know about it.
Well, you know, when you're on the phone with the IRS person that always calls me every day and wants my credit card, my social security number, yes, and I'm 12 numbers into my credit card, and I'm like, hey, you don't work for the IRS, do you?
Yeah. The funny thing is, I actually got a call like that from Microsoft Windows support saying that I had viruses. And then I said, well, the funny thing is, I said, oh, no way. Well, listen, I have to go right now. So can you give me your alias so I can contact you later on in the gal? And they're like, what? I'm like,
yeah, they wouldn't know.
Oh, yeah, I work for Microsoft. I work for Microsoft. And, you know, come on. And they're like, boom, click. So anyways.
But how would non-technical parent even deal with that? And it gets even more interesting when you start up-leveling. So you and I are talking about like the basics of phishing and, you know, non-technical parent, but supply chain attacks are something that are really interesting that have been coming up lately. And I know that you've been doing some webcasts to talk about that. The idea that you would get into my, you know, I'll use analogies again, right? You're going to get into my house by dealing with the person who mows my lawn and breaking into their car, and you do it by putting a bug in the tire. Like the guy who comes to my house to mow my lawn has a car. He's going to get a burr in his tire. He pops his tire. He goes to the tire place. I put a bug in the tire because I got a job at the mechanic shop, and then I broke into the billionaire's house or whatever. Like, that's like a movie. That's supply chain attacks. It's like it 3-4 levels back. Where do you even start?
It's very clever. You know, NPM is notorious for this. And well, I don't even want to blame NPM, because this is becoming pervasive across all the package managers. I mean, shoot, the whole dependency confusion thing that just recently happened, that was a big deal.
Could you expand on that?
Yeah, sure. So with the dependency confusion, there were packages that had a specific naming convention within private repos in organizations. And the way that the software was built, or at least I'm going to say the Microsoft software in this case, was that it would go and search for that name, and it would confuse where the location was for specific packages, meaning that it's conceivable that a bad actor could create a package with the same name in a public repository and cause these packages to be scooped up and injected into corporate code bases. So that's a great example of a supply chain type of attack. And so you look at NPM, and NPM's, you know, they've had their fair share, because what ends up happening is a lot of developers nowadays don't vet the source code. And I understand it. Some of the source code is thousands of lines deep, and their dependency chain spans 20, 30 complementary packages. So when you do NPM install and you're installing whatever, right. Shift left. What yep. was it? Pad left. You know, pad the infamous left, pad yeah. left. Yeah. You install pad left. God knows how many dependencies it's requiring. And so the dependency of the dependency of the dependency all the way down could mm-hmm. be that bad package, and you'd never know, because somebody took a dependency on it years ago, and then the project was abandoned and somebody took it over. So it's imperative that as you're going through your projects and you're building projects out, that you take the time to vet the source code in some fashion. So I know that there's a bunch of vendors that do this, like GitHub's trying to do that. GitHub is kind of moving into the software composition and analysis market, and Dependabot's a great example of that, where Dependabot will notify you. It's like, hey, this is an out-of-date version, or this is a compromised version, fix it, which is great. And those are the types of things that are really important. And so when you start looking at software, you know, SCA, that's what I like the acronym, and it analyzes your code base, these third-party dependencies for vulnerabilities, that's the type of stuff that helps you as a developer make sure that you can ingest this stuff in a safe way. One of the things that I always loved was NodeSource. And of course, I'm going back to my JavaScript days. And so you remember NodeSource, the company that was started by Joe McCann. Mm-hmm. And so, and I know Joe's at Microsoft now, which is so interesting. And so NodeSource was very clever, because they realized that this was going to become an issue. And they started a private, basically their own curated set of node packages that companies could kind of buy into and say, we've tested these, we know they're safe, we know they're working, and now companies can leverage that private repository instead of having to go out to a public repository, which could cause all types of concerns in terms of threats or even just compliance, especially when you start thinking about compliance from a licensing perspective. So there are all types of concerns that go into that, and I think supply chain is going to continue to be a pervasive issue. SolarWinds was a great example of that. And SolarWinds unfortunately affected thousands of companies. And it's not unique. I mean, that's just very high profile. Even PHP.net, that, you know, the open source project, they were trying to manage their own Git repository and Git infrastructure. And they got attacked by a threat actor that managed to inject some code. Now, thankfully, they had processes in place that caught it. But ultimately, that's a supply chain attack. You're injecting code in the hopes that somebody updates their software. And in this case, let's say it was PHP. Well, PHP runs on 70% of websites on the internet. That would have been catastrophic. So the implications are there. And as developers, we need to be aware of that. I guess that's the big thing I've been kind of preaching lately. And I do feel like I'm on a soapbox. We need to take security more seriously. Doesn't mean that everybody has to be a security expert, Scott. Mm-hmm. It just means that security, though, has to become more of a priority. The threat actors are switching over. Mm-hmm. The one thing I continue to say is that cloud infrastructure is just much more resilient to attacks. Amazon, Microsoft, and Google have done really good jobs at kind of building a good infrastructure process. And if you do it right, and you deploy an Azure instance or an AWS EC2 instance or whatever it is, and you set it up correctly, it's going to be pretty hardened. But what that does is it refocuses the attention to your applications. And as a developer, you need to be aware of these things.
Yeah.
Hey, friends, I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And I hope you take a look at one of our sponsors, CBT Nuggets. CBT Nuggets is an IT training online system for professionals and anyone really looking to build IT skills. It's kind of like Netflix for IT people. They've got lots of great stuff, but their core specialties are networking, cloud, and security, and they're putting up 40 hours of new training each week. Their entire trainer team is 100% in-house. They're all active IT professionals with multiple certifications. One of the great things that CBT Nuggets has that a lot of other folks don't have are virtual labs. These are actually on-demand virtual environments that are tailored to the course material that you're taking. and it allows you to actually practice networking configs, do scripts, run queries alongside the course. Best of all, accountability coaching. It's really hard to go and self-learn, but this service is available to all learners with a subscription. They have a coaching team that's integrated with their trainer and their content team, so you can talk to a real person at CBT Nuggets who will help you craft a personalized learning plan, set goals, and they'll check in with you to keep you accountable. And they've got a great 7-day free trial where you're going to get unlimited access to their entire training library. The promo URL is cbtnuggets.com/Hanselminutes. That's cbtnuggets.com/Hanselminutes. I think that the Dependabot thing is worth kind of going back on and talking about for a second, because it's such a great example of something that fits naturally into the developer's life cycle. Like to your point previously about code reviews, the idea that a bot is going to provide such incredible value to me, where it's going to be watching for threats, providing me pull requests as if it were a human. That seems like security that I could digest.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you use any type of browser extensions right now, whether you're on Microsoft New Edge, Chromium, or Chrome, or Firefox?
Of course.
Well, here's the interesting thing. So when I, with Firefox add-ons, initially they were vetted manually. Every Firefox add-on had their source code reviewed through every update, through an army of volunteers that would check line by line to find common patterns. And eventually they migrated to more of a hybrid where it's part automated for common patterns and then manual. Google does this as well. Google does, they vet their Chrome extensions through an automated system that checks for common patterns. So to your comment about bots, this is very similar to that. All these companies are realizing that they can capture at least the high profile issues if they have good machine learning, good AI, and good processes that can scan for common patterns and then follow those patterns across the way. And that's what these security companies tend to do as well. They're trying to leverage common patterns and common techniques to block bad actions. AMSI is a great example of that. Like, I love the fact that AMSI
is
built in. It's Microsoft's anti-malware scanning interface.
Okay.
It's built into PowerShell. It's built into .NET. I believe they just released AMSI into Office products as well. And so, like, PowerShell was one of the biggest post-exploitation vectors for threat actors. Like, for the longest time, PowerShell was what these bad actors would use to live off the land and get all through the system. They'd move laterally across networks using PowerShell and different tooling. Now they're using C#, you know, and .NET, because C# has, it's called reflection, and where you can reflect system processes and system DLLs. So now the bad actors are using that instead of PowerShell, because PowerShell is being detected by AMSI. So in essence, these types of capabilities, like AMSI, where it's trying to find bad patterns, is a way for that Microsoft's development team is trying to prevent some of these bad actions. Now, threat actors are clever. They're always going to find ways around it. But this is the type of stuff that as developers, we need to consider doing. We need to look at the patterns and then try to figure out what are the solutions to some of those patterns and at least mitigate some of these things.
Yeah, so the recognizing the patterns, whether it be a human, you call them security champions, that recognizes a pattern and then is enabled organizationally to speak up is another thing, right? They can't be Chicken Little who's just saying, hey, there's a security problem.
Oh, I love the fact you said that. It is definitely a conundrum. You can have security champions all day long. They can go ahead and say, look, I think this is the right way of doing things. And that's great. And ultimately, I see the security champions as the bridge builders. Like, you know, when we were in developer relations, what were we? We were bridge builders. We helped developers understand the business needs, and we helped the business folks understand tech talk and development talk. That's what I see security champions as. I can't say that they're going to be the blockers in terms of progress, and because business continuity obviously matters. But I think if you have people who can kind of bridge those conversations across different stakeholders, development, security, and business, then at least you have a voice of sanity that goes out there and says, look, we need to really reconsider this. If you get a VP who comes in there and says, well, I really don't care about this, we're going to push anyways, well, then that's just a business decision that has to be made. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. But at the very least, you have that voice of sanity that says, look, I made the call out. I think this is a problem. We need to address it. And at the very least, if we can't address it right now, let's figure out how we could address it once we've deployed it. Here's the thing. Not everything needs to break the build. That's the key thing. Our chief revenue officer, Mark Bissell, he has a great analogy. He says he calls having a catcher's mitt. And what it means is that you mm-hmm. do a scan, and the scan, doesn't break the build and allows the customer to deploy, right?
Right.
But then you have a full scan running in the background to make sure that once you go into production, that code base is having a complete thorough scan. So you may not get the complete high fidelity stuff on the initial scan. Mm-hmm. And that's dependent on you. But if you can do that high fidelity scan afterwards, at least you're doing the legwork to continue to have business continuity while ensuring that you're mitigating against threats. And oh, okay. I like that analogy, the catcher's mitt. That's the best way to say, you're protecting the home plate. Yeah. Kind of cool.
But the home plate, though, in that analogy, though, the home plate is the only plate that matters, right? Like that is the crown jewels. And it seems now that there's many, many moving targets from many directions.
There is. And security is a hard job. That's the best way to describe it. It's not, we're not going to stop everything. There's just no way. I think a lot about the small and medium sized business. I thought about it a lot when I was at Microsoft, and now even more so at Veracode. And the small to mid sized businesses are the ones that I feel for, because they don't have the mature security organizations in place to protect them. They don't have these massive security operation centers with these engineers that are constantly monitoring like the organizations that we've been in. And so these small to mid-sized businesses are the ones that they need to be more hyper-vigilant. They're the ones that if they don't make the investment in security, that's where it could have a trickle effect. And, you think about the fact that a lot of times these big organizations, when they get pwned, we were using that word, and they get pwned, a lot of times they're getting compromised via a third party. They're getting compromised via a partner. And it's a partner that provides them some kind of service, and that's how they get in. And so it's important that we start considering the needs of the small to medium-sized business when it comes to security and how to protect them. I don't have the clear solution.
Right.
But there has to be better alternatives for them that at least get them a little bit towards more of a mature model, security model.
Mm-hmm. You have publicly said that security training is fundamental in getting successful security training, assigning security champions. Are you saying every developer should suddenly become a security enthusiast? Like, do we have to have two jobs now? Or are you just saying that we just have a dearth of security training and we need to get some skills into the average developer?
I think at the very least, we should get some skills. I think if you're able to blend some developers who have at least the foundational understanding of security concepts and understand how to apply some of these foundational concepts into their development workflow, then that's great. And you're doing that in conjunction with more of the automated tools that I've mentioned many times. Mm-hmm. Then we need to have these folks who are really vested in learning about security, that they gravitate to it. I'm an example of that. I gravitated to security. I love it. I love being neck deep into that. I love tinkering and breaking boxes. And we need to nurture that. We need to cultivate that, because those are the defenders. Those are the ones that help to support the other folks who may not have that interest. Mm. And then, of course, we're going to have folks who are just completely dedicated to that. Those are the AppSec folks. Those are the folks that live, eat, breathe security in some fashion. Mm-hmm. And their whole goal in life is just to write flows and processes that help to protect the organization. So not everybody needs to be a security expert, but I think everybody should have an understanding. And I do think this has to start even before we get into the workplace. This has to start at the university level, and we're not doing that.
So then if you're listening to this podcast and you're a one or two or three person shop, or you're a consultant and you're doing, you know, a little bit of work on your own, how much of a security expert are you? What's the pie chart of your experience going to be if you're a Jack or Jill of all trades? Are you 30% security?
I think that's entirely up to you. I mean, it's going to be what your tolerance to learning a new skill is. It's learning a new language. Like right now, I'm going through the process of learning C# and .NET. And oh my God, the breadth of APIs is staggering. And so security is the same way. You have to make the investment. You have to sit down and say, I want to do this. If you're a two or three person shop, and especially if you're a consulting firm, obviously billable time comes in. And so you have to figure out, do I have that time to do it?
And shipping features as opposed to just saying, well, all that time was spent on security.
Yeah. And so you have to figure out, are your customers demanding it? If they're not demanding and they don't care, well, hey.
Well, I mean, I think customers, the problem with security is that it doesn't feel like a feature. It should be a feature, but the customer feels like, well, you failed to ship security because we got pwned, you know, a year after you shipped the thing to us.
It's viewed as a cost center. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. Security is a cost center. Development is a cost center.
Yeah.
And so businesses have to shift the way they view this as well. I can't tell you that there's a clear path for anybody to just embrace security into a consulting organization. I know how I do it. And if I was going to do it, I'd jump on something. I don't know, like, I'd take a web application penetration testing course from whether it's INE or offensive security or even on YouTube. There's so many numbers. Like even the company I have, we have a product called Security Labs, which allows people to attack like vulnerable applications just to get a feel for what's like to be a threat actor. And so you have resources out there that if you really are dedicated to learning about security, it's going to help you out. OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project, has a boatload of resources. They publish a top 10 list of vulnerabilities, things that are common within code bases. And they have a boatload of open source projects that you can download for free and just install them either into a VM or whatever it is, and practice figuring out what do these vulnerabilities look like and how do you remediate them. I think it's like anything, Scott. If you're a developer and security is an important part of your job, securing code bases is important part of your job, you just need to dedicate the time to it. I've seen your schedule. I know how much. Here's the thing. Having known you for 10 years now, I know how I'm going to say regimented you are with your schedule. I've adopted the Pomodoro technique because of a blog post you did, because it's the only way I can keep my sanity. But it's also allowing me to learn new things. And in security, I'm learning new things every single day. I'm by no means an expert. 3 years in, I'm still learning every single day.
Well, we've talked about this at length, right? I mean, we're all amateurs, because you could be an expert in security today, and then a new thing, a new researcher, a new whatever comes out tomorrow. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're having this conversation, is to understand what a developer needs to know, how to deal with the psychic weight of all of the threat actors that are out there trying to break into whatever they're trying to build. And finding the balance between analysis paralysis, where it's so overwhelming that you do nothing, and the impossibility of dedicating 99% of your time as a developer to security, that is a challenge. And I think for smaller organizations, it's difficult. And that's why I think automated tools, like you pointed out, like the ones that the company that you work for makes, or whether it be Dependabot or whatever, try to fit into that both the developer's inner loop as they are coding and deploying and testing and coding, and then the outer loop as you go and put things out into production.
Exactly. And so I do believe in lessening the friction. Development is a tough job. Right? Yeah. And anybody who says it's not, I don't know. I don't think they've been coding long enough to I just don't think so. And then you tack on something like security, and security, When you were you and I were talking, one of the things you said was, "Oh, it's this big scary thing, and it's nebulous, and it's like, oh, it's free flowing." It's like, some things are, but it's like, but then again, development the same way. I mean, 2005, it was jQuery, and then everything was jQuery, and now it's all about React. What was it before that? It was
Vue or Angular or
Vue.
Or
before that was Angular, and before that was Knockout, and then before that was Sencha, which was then EXTJS, and so on. And so things change all the time. And I will say that the one thing that's remained consistent throughout the years, though, has been .NET, for the most part, except for .NET Core. .NET Core now is a big change.
Yeah, I actually, this is not anything to do with security, but we recently moved Baby Smash, which is a game I made for my son, to .NET 5, and my son is now learning to drive, to give you a context about how .NET code from 15 years ago can still run, which makes me think now that I need to go and do some security penetration testing on the Baby Smash game that you can
get. There you go. Well, speaking of your sons are so big. I saw a video, and my goodness, I remember sending you mangoes. Remember the mangoes that I used to send you?
Yeah, they asked about the mango tree.
Yeah, no, the mango tree's in another house now. I can't go I can go and try to pilfer
some. There'd be some penetration testing there. You potentially sneak into their house under the guise of, under the dark cover of darkness, steal the mangoes, mail them to Oregon. This is all possible. I'll just need to hire you as a penetration tester to the...
Just make sure you have enough money to bail me out later on. Okay?
So. You got it. Thanks so much, Ray Bango, for chatting with me today about developers and making them more successful when we think about security. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.